From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Increasing numbers of people who are considered brain dead or who've been denied oxygen for long periods of time are being brought back to life due to medical breakthroughs. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with neurosurgeon and medical journalist Sanjay Gupta. His new book is Cheating Death: The Doctors and Medical Miracles That Are Saving Lives Against All Odds. Also, two of baseball's Hall of Famers, slugger Reggie Jackson and pitcher Bob Gibson, talk about the classic confrontation between the guy at the plate and the one on the mound. Their new book draws its name from the distance between the two on the field. It's called 60 Feet, 6 Inches. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. If a relative has been in a deep coma for months, how do you know when it's time to let go? When a team of emergency room doctors and nurses work to revive a heart attack victim, at what point do they give up and declare the patient dead? My guest, Sanjay Gupta, says those questions are getting harder to answer as new medical treatments enable doctors to save and revive patients whose hearts have stopped beating for long periods of time or who've seemed brain dead for weeks. Gupta is a practicing neurosurgeon and associate chief of neurosurgery at Grady Memorial Hospital and an assistant professor at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta. He's also a medical journalist. He's a columnist for Time Magazine and chief medical correspondent for CNN. His new book is Cheating Death: Doctors and Medical Miracles That Are Saving Lives Against All Odds. Well, Sanjay Gupta, welcome to Fresh Air. I thought we'd begin with this remarkable story that you tell early in the book of this Norwegian skier who takes a plunge in the mountains and gets trapped in freezing water for something like 2 hours and manages somehow to recover. How?
It is a remarkable story, even for someone like me who's been studying this for a couple of years, who's had the opportunity to travel around the world and talk to the foremost researchers in hypothermia, in extreme survival. This story is sort of the pinnacle of even that. This is a woman who has, I guess, the dubious honor of being the coldest ever human being who subsequently went on to live. This is a woman who was declared dead in a hospital in Tromsø, Norway, and now is a practicing physician at that same hospital. She was found after she fell into a stream, a sort of frozen stream, on a very cold place, and this is Tromsø, Norway, which is north of the Arctic Circle and one of the northern more points of Norway. What we know now is that she struggled for around 30 minutes or so. She was probably getting pockets of air, which is why she could last that long, and then she just stopped. And by the time they got her out of that frozen stream, she was dead. She had no spontaneous respiration. She had no spontaneous heartbeat. She had no blood pressure. Her pupils were dilated, indicating that her brain had become swollen. She was dead. And it was at this point that I think that a critical decision was made. The decision was to go ahead and leave her cold. The idea was that this cold could somehow be protective. It could somehow stimulate an almost hibernation-like reflex in the body. We know that there was no oxygen traveling through the body, but because she was cold, the body really wasn't demanding oxygen either.
So how cold was she? How cold was her body?
She was 13.7 degrees Celsius, so right around 55 degrees or so. And again, that's the coldest recorded temperature of someone actually surviving.
How long did they decide to leave her in this hypothermic state?
Several hours. They did not warm her up at the scene, which is what often happens, even with blankets and then warm saline and things like that. And they did not warm her up right away when she finally got to the hospital. They waited a few hours and then slowly, very slowly, started to rewarm her using these temperature gradients, so just a few degrees at a time.
And what happened?
Well, what happened is that, you know, they got her in there and they realized that, you know, she really had no heartbeat. And sometimes you can't tell in the field, you know, it's tough to check a pulse. But now they're doing an echocardiogram directly looking at her heart, and she really has no heartbeat. So now they're very concerned, and they say, we're going to slowly start to rewarm her, and we're also not going to give her any extra IV fluids. One thing they learned is that when you start to go into this hibernation-like state from cold, from hypothermia, all your blood vessels become very leaky. They leak fluid. So if you give a lot of fluid, that fluid starts to leak, and if it leaks into the brain or into the lungs, that can cause death. So I gave no fluids, slowly rewarmed her, and then there was this great moment where all of a sudden the heart, which was doing nothing, you had a true, what's known as asystole, that flat line on EKG, and all of a sudden it started to come back. And it was a magical moment, as they described it to me when I was visiting them in Tromsø. But I think they were still concerned that her brain had gone for too long without oxygen. How could the body tolerate this? But as I said, you know, she slowly recovered. At first, she was paralyzed almost in her entire body from lack of oxygen to her brain. But over a period of time, she continued to recover, finished her medical school, which she was a medical student at the time, and is now a doctor in that same hospital.
The subject that you discuss after this remarkable story really involves the use of hypothermia, chilling a body as a therapy. And if I understand what you're saying, that in many acute cases of where someone has a heart attack or a severe trauma and looks as if, you know, they're going to die or maybe actually stop breathing, that deliberately lowering the body temperature can be a, can be, I don't want to use the word miraculous, but a remarkable therapy, right?
It really can. And you know, with this particular skier, obviously it wasn't intentional. But in some ways, it was almost a perfectly executed form of hypothermia. The way her body chilled at the rate that it chilled, they were able to piece that together, actually worked very much in her favor. They figured that out in retrospect. But every day, hospitals use hypothermia, for example, when people are having certain types of open heart procedures, having certain types of brain procedures, it is used. The idea is that, look, we know for a period of time, we're going to put the body in a state where it can't deliver. It can't do what it's supposed to do. At least the heart can't pump oxygenated blood throughout the body. So we have a couple of choices here. One of those choices is to reduce the demands of the body. Oh, not enough oxygen there? Well, let's make it so the body doesn't need as much oxygen. And that's sort of where hypothermia, among other things, sort of comes in.
Now, is this a technique that can be used by paramedics as they arrive in, you know, at medical emergencies around the country?
Right.
Are they starting to use hypothermia as a therapy?
There's great literature on this now. If you're walking down the street and you see someone have a sudden cardiac arrest, their chances of survival is very much related to a couple of different things. One is if someone helps them, that greatly improves their chance of survival, as you might imagine, a bystander. But also this idea of hypothermia. So paramedics now, in addition to having their medication bag and their defibrillators, and in several cities now around the country are carrying these ice chests filled with cold saline, ice cold saline. And as part of their therapy, right in the field, is to immediately start infusing this ice cold saline to start to bring the temperature down. So when you think about things like hypothermia, what you're really doing more than anything else is stealing away some time from death. You know, death and life are sort of battling it out at this point in some critical situation, perhaps after a cardiac arrest. And what you're saying is, you know, if we could only have a few more minutes, if we could only have a few more hours, the body's going to be able to recover from this. So let's buy a few more hours using something like hypothermia. That's one way to do it.
You also write that one thing that emergency medical personnel have learned that is that you actually get better results when administering CPR if you leave out the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Why?
I found this to be one of the most fascinating things that I've really covered for a few different reasons. If I can back up for one second and just say that if you ask people if they see someone collapse in front of them on the street, would they help? And most people will say yes in poll after poll. But that doesn't seem to translate to what actually happens. People seem to not help as much as they say they'd like to. What we know is if someone has a sudden cardiac arrest and there's no bystander help, their chance of survival is around 3%. If someone helps, just jumps in and helps, that survival rate can go up by 400 to 500%. So a significant improvement. When they asked people why wouldn't they help? What was the concern? And the concern really seemed to be more about mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And they were concerned, A, that they didn't know how to do it, or they just didn't feel comfortable doing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. So these researchers say, okay, well, let's sort of think about this and figure out models. Can we just create a chest compression-only model? And if so, how would it work and how effective would it be? And cutting to the chase here, after years of research, they figured out not only was it as effective as cardiopulmonary resuscitation, where you're giving breaths, they found it was actually more effective. And the reason is pretty simple. The reason is that if someone has a sudden cardiac arrest, they probably have a fair amount of oxygen already in their blood. After all, they were just breathing, so the oxygen is there. The key now, more than anything else, is to get that oxygenated blood moving through the body. So just call 911, push on the chest 100 times a minute, and don't stop for anything. That seems to be the key. Move that oxygenated blood throughout the body, and then when the paramedics get there, you know, they continue the process until they get to the hospital.
Dr. Sanjay Gupta's new book is called Cheating Death, The Doctors and Medical Miracles That Are Saving Lives Against All Odds. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Sanjay Gupta. He is a neurosurgeon and medical journalist. He's written a new book about the line between life and death and medical efforts to reverse the effects of dying called Cheating Death. One of the more fascinating parts of this book involves brain death. You know, we've come to regard death as less a function of the heart stopping its beats than when the brain ceases to function. And you describe some treatments that have shown some remarkable results in reversing these, you know, persistent vegetative states that some patients are in. Give us an example of a case that illustrates some of these, you know, some of these new treatments.
Yeah, what we sort of realize is that this idea that the brain is really dead. You know, looking at an EEG, for example, which measures electrical activity of the brain. And seeing it as silent or not having any activity, maybe not that good of a measure after all, or even showing low blood flow to the brain or no blood flow to the brain, maybe not a very good measure. There's a few stories in here that I think really gave me a lot to think about when I heard them and then researched them and then validated them, where patients could describe with surprising accuracy exactly what was happening around them and to them at a time when doctors thought that they were brain dead. The hypothermia, which we talked about earlier, was something that seemed to make a difference with patients who we thought were brain dead and subsequently made a recovery. Putting the brain to sleep again with a combination of cold and some medications really seemed to make a difference.
Just a bit, we're talking about cases where someone has had a severe head injury or perhaps a heart attack and have lost blood flow to the brain and their brains appear not to be functioning. You're saying that in cases like this where it appears there is no hope and this person lying in the bed, maybe on a ventilator, is never going to come back, we're never going to see them, there are cases where interventions have actually produced a reversal of these. And you said one of them is hypothermia. I mean, they chill the body, chill the brain. How does that work?
Yeah, that's exactly right. They chill the brain, and it works in a sort of amazingly simple way. I mean, they literally take ice packs and wrap it around the person's body. They use cold saline, injecting it into the bloodstream, and they sort of put the brain into a deep chill. That's essentially what they're doing. And with that, they're hoping for two things. One is that the brain will repair itself if there was some sort of traumatic injury during that time. But also they're sort of turning the brain off for a while. You know, they know that the brain doesn't like even a small amount of time without getting lots of nutrient-rich blood bathing it. And if you turn it off, it doesn't really need that blood anymore. So those are sort of the two basic principles of that. But I think, you know, that this idea that there are patients that we say, okay, they're brain dead. And in the United States, that means they're dead. In different countries, it means different things. But we use brain death as a criteria here in the United States. And then I go talk to these patients. I look through their charts. They were declared brain dead. It was written in their chart as such. And here they are sitting up talking to me. Hypothermia probably played a role. Medications probably played a role. But I think the larger message to me and what I really spent the last couple of years thinking about was, we don't really know when to give up, and we really don't know what dead really means. We thought we did, but here this guy's talking to me, and you know, a bunch of people with crisp white coats and hundreds of years of medical experience combined all urged this man's wife to pull the plug because they didn't think he'd ever recover, and here he is talking to me. What is dead? That's what I kept sort of stumbling upon and trying to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, that really has very profound implications. I mean, anyone who is lying there and appears to be gone, I mean, you know, if their body's in shape but the brain isn't functioning, how would you know when to ever give up treatment?
And that was a really difficult thing for me to tangle with in the book because Yeah, I'm not trying to malign doctors or certainly indict anybody. That's not the purpose at all. And obviously there are lots of patients who really won't recover. And I think for the most part, the system works well. But there are patients who do make these really astounding recoveries. And the question, you could just call them a miracle or an outlier or say, you know, we don't know and chalk it up to that. Or you could say, let's really dissect down why this person lived and is functioning so well when so many others wouldn't. What is it about them? Is it about them or is it about the techniques or, you know, what were all those micro pieces that came together to create this remarkable recovery?
And do you feel like, you know, you're a neuroscientist. I mean, are folks getting a better handle on what's happening and how they can tell when someone will recover and when they won't?
They're starting to get a better handle on it. But I think that there's, you know, as often happens in medicine, with some more answers come a lot more questions. This idea that people's brains continue to work and continue to process things, even at a time when we think it doesn't or we even think that it's dead, really, I think in many ways is blowing the lid off of what we know about neuroscience. There was a great story of a woman in England who was, you know, essentially considered to be in a persistent vegetative state. And they put this woman in what's known as a functional MRI scanner. That's a scanner that measures the activity of brain. It shows where certain parts of the brain are lighting up. And as you'd expect, when they first did this MRI scan, there was nothing lighting up. This woman was in a persistent vegetative state. But then the doctors, the researchers in this case, decided to ask her a few questions. And one of the questions they asked her was about tennis. They knew that she liked to play tennis. So they said to her, again, this woman who to the world was doing nothing, she was, you know, just lying there. They said, imagine playing tennis. What would you do? How would you hold the ball? How would you hold the racket? What would you do exactly? And they saw something that I think probably stunned them into silence. And that is that the motor areas of the brain started to light up. This woman who they thought couldn't hear a thing, was doing nothing, she was imagining playing tennis because they asked her to do it. The motor area is the exact area that you'd expect to light up, was doing just that. And I think that we're just starting to learn more and more about what the brain is capable of doing, even when we think it's doing nothing.
Right. That also meant that she was hearing and comprehending what they were telling her when she could do nothing in response.
That's exactly right, which shows an executive level of function of the brain. When I delved into it and I talked to these researchers specifically about it, they said, look, you know, you go around any place in the world and look at these diagnoses, persistent vegetative state, coma, all that sort of stuff. You go to nursing homes where elderly people are given this diagnosis, and you'll find that about a third of the time the diagnosis is wrong. I mean, inherent within the definition of persistent vegetative state is some idea of permanence, this idea that it's persistent. But in fact, these patients can recover. We don't know why, for sure. We don't know exactly how, but they can. I think these terms are probably terms we shouldn't be using because we don't know exactly what's persistent or permanent by any means.
Do you speak to patients differently now that you know some may be hearing you that you didn't think weren't?
Yes, I do. And it's been a conscious decision really over the last several months because I needed to convince myself. I wasn't cynical about whether this could be happening, but I was a bit skeptical. And I started to read a lot about this and more than reading the scientific literature, which I spent a lot of time doing, just talking to these patients and really convincing myself that, look, this wasn't by chance. Some of the stories, it just couldn't be. I mean, someone remembering exactly where a doctor placed his glasses when he was thought to be brain dead. They couldn't find his glasses. When he finally recovers, he says, I know where my glasses are. They're over here. How could he have known that? You know, the only way he could have known that if he was actually processing things at the time that doctor in a rush sort of hid those. So after I convinced myself, I do talk to patients now who are otherwise would be considered either in a persistent vegetative state or in having a really, really low coma scale, meaning that, you know, they're not interacting or able to process anything as far as we know. I behave differently around them now.
I can't let you go without asking you what it feels like not to be the nation's Surgeon General. You were, it was widely reported that President Obama spoke to you about becoming Surgeon General earlier this year, and it was reported it looked as if you might be taking it. And in the end, you said, you know, the demands of your professional life and a desire to be with your family kept you from serving. Do you look back and wonder what you might be doing? I mean, you know, never has health care been a more, you know, more of a public issue than it is today.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a big fan of public service. I've been a public servant before. I've worked at the White House. I don't live in the world of regrets by any means. And for me, this was a very personal decision. I have three young children. I would have been a commuting dad for a few years. One of the things that I didn't realize as I was going into the process was that the Surgeon General cannot practice surgery anymore. I'm 39 years old. I thought that if I didn't practice for 4 years or 8 years, depending on what happens with President Obama, then I wouldn't be going back to being a neurosurgeon. And I just didn't think it was the right thing for me. I like being a doctor. I like taking care of patients. And sure, you know, there's sometimes a little bit of wistfulness, but I don't think there's any regrets about it. This was a personal decision, and you know, my family and we're very happy with it.
Well, Sanjay Gupta, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Sanjay Gupta is a neurosurgeon at Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta. He's also a columnist for Time Magazine and chief medical correspondent for CNN. His new book is Cheating Death: Doctors and Medical Miracles That Are Saving Lives Against All Odds. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Cabot Creamery Cooperative, five generations of New England and New York farm families working together to produce naturally aged traditional Vermont cheddar cheese. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose Subsidy Scope project provides information about federal subsidies across industries at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR.
Coming up, baseball greats Reggie Jackson and Bob Gibson take us inside the time-honored confrontation between hitter and pitcher. We'll hear how to recognize a fastball, a slider, or a curve in less than half a second, and how not to stop a hard line drive hit by Roberto Clemente. Their new book is 60 Feet, 6 Inches. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Few confrontations in sports are as personal and dramatic as a batter standing in against a pitcher with a baseball game on the line. The batter adjusts his helmet, tightens his batting gloves, digs into the batter's box, and looks toward the mound. The pitcher fingers a rosin bag and drops it, stares at the catcher for a sign, then grips the ball in his glove and begins his windup. If his pitch is a major league fastball, it will reach the plate in less than half a second. The strategies, emotions, and sometimes explosive confrontations that arise from that duel are at the heart of a new book by two legends of Major League Baseball, Reggie Jackson and Bob Gibson. Jackson was a home run hitter who won five World Series rings with Oakland and New York and earned the nickname Mr. October for his postseason heroics. Gibson was one of the most intimidating pitchers who ever played, an 8-time All-Star who won 2 championships with the St. Louis Cardinals. Both were extraordinary performers in the World Series, and both are in baseball's Hall of Fame. Their new book is based on a series of recorded conversations with writer Lonnie Wheeler. It takes its name from the distance between the pitcher's mound and home plate. It's called 60 Feet, 6 Inches. Well, Reggie Jackson, Bob Gibson, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, Bob Gibson, you say in this book that if you were a pitcher today, there are a lot more coaches and trainers and video analysis, and they would get you to try and change your windup and make it more economical, fewer moving parts. You had a lot of movement in your windup. Was that conscious?
Well, it was the way I learned to pitch. And my idea, it wasn't just my idea. I think back in the days and even before I pitched, guys would wind up and they would go through all types of gyrations. And the hitter pretty much had to look for the ball. Where is it going to come from? And I think the more that he has to look for, the better off you are. They start pitching with no wind up and as little movement as possible. And more guys start hitting the ball 550 feet. I think that the hitter needs to look and try to figure out where that ball is coming from.
You write in the book, and this book is a collection of conversations with you guys, and at one point you say, I had a violent delivery. I wanted to be a gathering storm and blow that fastball in there with all the force and fury I could muster. Was that Bob Gibson? He just really being an intimidating force out there with that windup?
Well, yeah, kind of, except I had just more than a fastball. And I think what made me such a good pitcher was that my slider was just as good as my fastball. And I had just as good a control with my slider as a fastball. And what makes you really effective is that you get guys up there looking for a 95, 97 mile an hour fastball, and you throw them a slider that's 89 and 90. And I think that's why I did so well in the series, because those guys were looking for all fastballs.
And coming out of that, all that different motion, they're worried about the speed, and then suddenly the ball's curving, it's dipping, it's off speed.
Oh, yeah, they're looking for the ball off of me. You know, what the hitter likes to do is to see where that point of release is coming from. And I think it's more difficult if your arms are waving and flapping, and not that everybody can do that. I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. But I think the more he has to look for, the better off you are.
Reggie Jackson, would you be bothered by a pitcher's windup if there was a lot of motion there?
You try not to. I know that I liked it when a guy had almost a pitching motion of a catcher, just kind of a nice, easy throw, not too much movement. It made it a lot easier to follow. But following a Gibson, following a Tiant, a Juan Marichal, a Warren Spahn, a Vida Blue, Jim Palmer, guys with big high kicks like Steve Carlton, it makes it tougher. Nolan Ryan had a big kick. Bert Blyleven had a big kick. And when these guys had all that going on and then threw in the high 90s to go along with it, with a 12-6 breaking ball, it made it an awful lot tougher, I thought.
You guys were both in the Hall of Fame because you were great players in the regular season, but you really, really stood out in championship games when it was all on the line. You both were incredible performers in the World Series. Reggie Jackson, nobody else in the game has hit 4 homers on 4 consecutive swings in the World Series like you did in 1977. You have 5 World Series championships. What were those big games like for you? Did it feel different? Was your focus different?
It was a battle between me and the guy on the mound, and I knew everything about who I was facing, even the other league. We had scouting reports. I paid attention to them. I watched. I learned. I understood. I felt prepared. And I really wanted a guy that I was facing to be at his best, because then it made the thinking easy, because he understood what a guy had, which was his best pitcher, say, like facing a guy like Bob Gibson in a World Series. Be proud of what you got, because then I know what I'm going to get. I may not be able to handle it, but the thinking gets simple. Mm-hmm. He's not going around me unless the situation calls for it, meaning pitch around me and face another hitter, depending on the score of the situation. I felt I was going to have a good swing. I felt prepared. So the game got a little more simple. I didn't have any clutter in my mind. It's me and you. Uh-huh. I'm ready and so are you. I hope you had a good night's rest. I hope you had a big breakfast. Kiss your wife and your baby goodbye. Get your insurance paid up.
Because here it
Grab
comes.
Grab that can over there before you come
right.
in here.
Well, he's right about that because when we got into the series, he was going to get what I had unless there was a situation where I needed to pitch around him. And
that meaning walk him and face the next guy, right? Yeah.
You know, Reggie's up there, and Reggie's not going to get a hit every time he's up there, nor is he going to hit a home run every time he's up there. But he's probably more capable of hitting one than the guy behind him. So why do a silly thing, especially if you're in a situation where he could win, he could beat you a ball game? You would pitch around him, that meaning pitch to the next hitter, a guy that you know you can get out or you suspect you can get out a lot better than him. If I don't make a mistake on Reggie, I'm going to get him out. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether I'm going to make a mistake. If I do make a mistake, he's going to hit it. Mm-hmm. So let's try somebody else. And that's the way I looked at it.
The fascinating thing hearing you two talk is that you never faced each other either in the postseason or in the regular season, right?
All-Star game.
In the All-Star game, right?
And yeah, he keeps telling me he had a double off of me, and I don't remember it.
We're speaking with Bob Gibson and Reggie Jackson. They collaborated with Lonnie Wheeler on the new book, 60 Feet, 6 Inches. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guests are Hall of Fame ballplayers Reggie Jackson and Bob Gibson. They collaborated with Lonnie Wheeler on a new book called 60 Feet, 6 Inches. Bob Gibson, I got to ask you about the 1964 World Series, where you pitched in Game 7 on only 2 days' rest. That's very little rest, after having won Game 5. Took the game all the way into the ninth inning with a 7-3 lead, then gave up 2 homers. And your manager, Johnny Keene, left you in. You finished, you won the game, you were the most valuable player of the series. And afterward, when Johnny Keene asked why he left Gibson in, who was seemed to be tired after pitching only 9 innings on only 2 days' rest, he said, I never considered taking him out. I had a commitment to his heart. Tell me about that day and that relationship.
Well, first you got to – I blame Johnny Keene for those last 2 home runs that they hit off of me. I go out, and Johnny says, Bob, I don't want you to get fancy out there. I want you to throw the ball, every pitch, fastball, right over the middle of the plate. He says, I don't think that they're going to hit 4 home runs. And so after the second one, I looked into the dugout, and Johnny was getting a drink of water. I was looking to see, where are you, John? Are you sure they're not going to hit 4? But, you know, I have a commitment to his heart. I can't tell you exactly what he had in mind when he said that. I know that he had plenty of confidence in me, and he felt that he was going to just go down the line with me, win, lose, or draw. Now, that's saying something for him. I didn't want to let him down, period. And I was tired. I was really tired out there. But he was going to leave me in there, so I was going to give it everything I had.
Yeah, I think what he meant was that this man has a will to win like no other.
Yeah, but you keep throwing that fastball over the middle of the plate. Mm-hmm. That will might dwindle.
I want to talk about throwing inside and guys getting hit by pitches, because you guys have both been on opposite ends of this. And Bob Gibson, with your permission, I'm going to read a section from you from the book that you've collaborated with Reggie here, where you're talking about, you're saying basically that you like to pitch on the outside part of the plate, that is the part, pitch away from the batter. And you say that nobody's really going to square on a pitch and hit you when you pitch it outside. And then you write, unless he cheats. What I mean is, unless he leans in and dives at that outside corner. Obviously, I can't let him do that because that's where I'm trying to pitch. So if he tries it, I have to stand him up a little bit. Think of the hitter as a dog with an electronic collar. You just administer a slight correction, as they call it, if he tries to get out of his yard. Throw the ball inside, and he can't wander into the wrong area. That's what you were doing when you pitched inside, right?
Pretty much, yeah. I was getting him to think about the ball inside. Now, Reggie likes to hit the ball out away from him. That's where I want to get him out. So what do I do to keep him from hitting that ball out away from him? I pitch him inside. And I don't just pitch him inside once. I come in there often. And so now he's going to think about me pitching him inside. If he's thinking about that ball inside, then I can get him out of the way. If he's thinking outside and I throw outside, he's more capable of hitting the ball. But if I get inside and do it often enough, he's not going to go leaning out there. Because sometimes when I'm pitching inside and he's thinking outside, you know, the ball comes inside and it'll hit him. So and he knows it. So he says, well, maybe he's going to come in here. More often than not, I'm going to be away from him. But it just might be that one time that I'm not away from him, and he's going to get hurt. It'll come in and bite him.
Well, and a Bob Gibson fastball can hurt you, no doubt. Reggie Jackson, you know, the lure is that pitchers now throw at and throw close to hitters a lot less than they did years ago. I want to – back when you played – how did you feel when a pitcher, you know, knocked you down, threw it in so that you had to jump out of the way? What were the circumstances under which that was okay?
Well, you added something there okay. That's very important. There were circumstances where it was okay. If you hit a good hitter on the other ball club, then somebody on our club was going to get hit, and you know, certain pitchers would make sure they hit either the most important guy, or if you hit the second most important guy over there, you'd hit the second most important guy on our club. And they may just single out and say, okay, we're going to knock Reggie down. Right. We're going to hit him. And you understood it at times, especially if we started and a guy hit a couple of home runs against us, and the pitcher had to hit the guy in order to just you know, get him to respect him a little bit.
Now that's what
just can't get abused.
I've got to interrupt you there because that's one thing that I never did understand. If someone hits two home runs fair and square, is having a great day, that's a reason to throw at him.
Go ahead.
Well,
Bob Gibson. Yeah,
and let me say this: a guy hitting a home run off of me is not a reason for me to throw at the guy. If the guy hits my best pitch in a good location and he hits a home run, that's a reason for me to throw at him. You know what I mean? I don't want him getting my best pitch. There's a lot of mistakes that I'm going to make. And when I make a mistake, he's capable of hitting a home run. Well, that's my fault. But when he goes out and get my really, really good pitch and hits a home run off it, he might have to get hit the next time.
Now, when you say hit, you're talking about not just coming close. You're talking about drilling him in the ribs?
Hit you in the back.
Well,
the butt.
Yeah, in the ribs or somewhere in there.
Somewhere where it's not bad. If you throw at a guy's head, then we all feel, pitcher as well as hitter, that, you know, you're trying to do some damage or you're messing with my livelihood.
Yeah.
But there are times in baseball when I was coming along, and Bobby too, that you just hit guys, and that was part of the game. There is no question that in the 50s and 60s, black players got thrown at more. That's not a negative comment. It may come out that way, but that's the way it was. Hitting another player was part of the game. Hitting a player in the head is not. When you hit a player in the head, you're more apt to get some fisticuffs or, you know, bring both teams out on the field. But it was more accepted in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I think nowadays it's a little over-policed because I will always believe that knocking a hitter down, even hitting a hitter at some times, is part of baseball.
Right. And there was this tradition of retaliation, which still happens today, where a pitcher from one team hits a guy on another team. Then the batting team's pitcher, when they get back out in the field, will be expected to hit one of their hitters. And then Bob Gibson, that might have put you in the position then sometimes of having to plunk somebody who, because of something that had happened while your team was at bat. How did you feel about that, having to go out there? They call it protecting your team, right?
Yeah, I had no problem with it at all. Now, they used to say, well, wait for the pitcher and get him. I said, no. The pitcher might not even be in the game when you know it's his time to hit. So I would usually, the next inning I pitch, I'd hit the first guy up, And then maybe I would get the best hitter on our team. But I wanted to retaliate so they wouldn't forget, you know. And I just wouldn't wait. And they knew this. The first guy that came up to the plate, he was really in light slippers.
Right. And nowadays they promote wait till the right time, wait till you have two outs, wait till you have a lead. And so pick your spot is what it's called.
Well, and umpires will throw you out. They will warn both benches, and then when you hit somebody, you get tossed out, which didn't
happen. I don't like that.
Mm-hmm. I had a situation. It was in San Diego. Lee Weyer happened to be the umpire. And we got somebody hit on our ball club, and they knew my reputation as retaliating. You know, and it wasn't any – I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. I was going to hit them. And after the inning, the half inning was over, and I'm walking to the mound – Lee Weyer was walking along with me. Now, Bobby.
So the umpire.
Now, Bobby, if you hit somebody, it's going to cost you $50. It's going to cost you $50. And I said, Lee, and at that time I was making pretty good money. I said, Lee, I have a whole bunch of $50, so you start adding them up. And he didn't kick me out. First guy up, I didn't hit him. I knocked him down.
Okay.
And he didn't kick me out of the ballgame.
Sent the message. You know, one thing it's always fascinated me is when ball players get hit, and I know it hurts, they never rub it. What's that about, Reggie Jackson?
Oh, that's not true.
That's not true. If you get hit and it hurts, I'm going to rub it.
Willie Davis.
I see guys just walk it off, and I don't know how
Willie
they do
Davis
it.
Willie Davis was hitting off of me, and my slider was 89, 90 miles an hour. And he swung at a slider of mine, and it hit him in the knee. And he didn't rub it. And I was wondering, ooh, I wonder what that's all about. And he hit a ground ball, and he got halfway to first and fell. I said, no, that's more like it. Now I knew. He's got to rub his thing or something.
You know, Reggie Jackson, I know that you were hit in the head a few times and hit once in the face by Doc Ellis. And I'm just wondering, right, after something like that, how do you stand in ever again, 60 feet away from a guy that can throw a fastball? Doesn't it affect your nerves?
Well, I went out to the ballpark after I got hit in the head one time, in the face by Doc Ellis, and around 1 o'clock, because I sat out 2 days, and I went out to the ballpark the next day with a big swollen face and almost a closed eye because I was going to play that night. And I had the batting practice pitcher, a guy by the name of Jimmy Fry, who was a manager for the Cubs, throw at me in batting practice, and I hit for about 45 minutes and got over that. There's another time in Texas, a guy had hit me in the head by the name of Mike Paul, a left-hander for Cleveland. I played against him in college. He hit me in college, and then we got together in the pros. I hit a home run off him in Cleveland, and then about 4 or 5 years later, he was pitching for Texas, and I came up to the plate, and there were two guys on, and the catcher was a kid named Kenny Suarez, who was about 5'7", and the umpire was Bill Haller. And I got in the batter's box, and the first pitch that this guy threw to me was up and in. And I turned around to Ken Suarez, and I said, I'm not going to be able to get to the pitcher's mound, but if he hits me, I'm going to rip your face mask off and whoop you right here at home plate. He called time and went to the pitcher's mound. And he looked at the umpire, and the umpire looked at me, and he went to the pitcher's mound and said something to Mike Paul, and the next three pitches was over in the right-hand hitter's batter's box. I got to walk.
I like that. I like that.
I'm going to fight you.
I think, though, if I had been catching, you and I would have been rolling in the dirt. Oh, yeah.
We're speaking with Reggie Jackson and Bob Gibson, both Hall of Fame ball players who have collaborated on a new book called 60 Feet, 6 Inches. We'll talk more right after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guests are Hall of Fame ballplayers Reggie Jackson and Bob Gibson. They've collaborated with Lonnie Wheeler on a new book called 60 Feet, 6 Inches. Reggie Jackson, I have to ask you one thing that I've always wanted to ask a great hitter, and that is, when a pitcher releases the ball, it's on top of you so quickly, and you have a much better chance if you can tell whether it's a fastball or a slider or a curve. Can you actually see the rotation of the ball and tell what kind of pitch it is?
Dave, if you can't see the rotation and tell if it's a sinker, a fastball, then you have to be able to tell whether that fastball is a two-seamer or a four-seamer. You have to be able to recognize if it's a slider or a curveball. You have to be able to recognize if it's a changeup or a split finger. And if you can't, you're not going to be a major league player. You're not going to be a good player. Any other player that's playing every day that's hitting above 275 or 260, he can see what's coming when it leaves the pitcher's hand.
Uh-huh. So, in that split second, you can pick up the rotation,
yes,
and see what's
coming.
Yes,
you better.
That's amazing.
You better.
That's amazing.
And a guy that with a slider like Bob, you'd see a dot. You'd see a dot in the ball, and you wouldn't yet. You'd see that dot. If that dot got big and you saw it too clear, it was a bad slider, and it was going to leave the ballpark when you swung at it.
You saw a dot. What do you mean by the dot, Reggie?
Just the spin of the baseball with a slider, the rotations in the seams form a dot, a red dot, you know, on the ball as it comes at you,
right,
when it's a real good slider. Okay. The guys will say, boy's tight. It's electric. If it got sloppy, the dot got big, and then it became a hanger. It became a bad fastball.
And Bob Gibson, I have to ask you about one more moment. I don't remember the year, but you always talked about how Roberto Clemente was the kind of player that would just leap out and lunge at pitches away from him wherever. And he once hit a line drive at you that hit you so hard it broke your leg, right?
Yes, that happened.
And you pitched for three more batters before you left?
Well, I pitched it two more anyway, and I used to get Clemente out fairly easily, and it was because of him jumping and leaping out at that ball away. And I used to throw the first pitch inside, knock him down. I mean, knock him down on purpose. Didn't hit him. I don't think I ever hit him. But it would make him so mad that he would swing at everything. And then the next pitches, I wouldn't even throw a strike. I'd strike him out. I'd get him out. He'd hit ground balls. And this one time in particular was in 1967. It was right before the All-Star break. And I got a ball up and away. You could get Clemente out if it's down and away, down and away. And they tell you pitch guys low and away and high and tight. And that means pitching them up and in and low and away. And if you got it up and away to Clemente, he hit the ball to right field like a left-handed pull hitter. I mean, he just really smashed it. And so I got the ball up a little bit. But it wasn't letter high. It was about belt high. And he hit a line drive. And about the time my right leg hit the ground, I wasn't able to get my glove down quick enough. And the line drive hit me right on the ankle, broke my fibula. I didn't know it was broken. I just knew it hurt a lot. And so our trainer came out. And back in those days, they would spray this ethyl chloride on your leg, and it would freeze it, and you wouldn't feel anything. And our trainer freezed it. He put that stuff on it, and I said, he says, how you feel? Well, I felt fine. I couldn't feel it. And so I threw a couple of pitches, and I said, yeah, it's okay. They went back away, and I started pitching, and I ended up getting 3-2 on Don Clendenin. And I knew that he was going to look for a fastball, so I was going to put a little bit extra on it. And I put a lot of weight on that bone, and it popped, it snapped in half. And it was really kind of scary. I looked behind me because I thought somebody walked up and hit me with a stick. But I fell over, and I passed out. Next thing I know, everybody was looking in my face. But I didn't know it was broken. I just thought I had gotten a little bruise on it. And today that would never happen. You get hit like that and they take you out. They take a little better care of you.
So that's how you get Bob Gibson out of a game.
Well, they certainly got me out of the game that day.
Well, Bob Gibson, Reggie Jackson, thanks so much. It's been fun.
Okay, my friend. Thanks for having us.
Bob, thanks a lot.
Well, you're very welcome.
Bob Gibson and Reggie Jackson are both Hall of Famers who have 7 World Series titles between them. Their new book with writer Lonnie Wheeler is called 60 Feet, 6 Inches.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd.
You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LendingTree, providing customers with the ability to manage their money, credit, and loans all in one place at LendingTree.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Spike Jonze, the director of Being John Malkovich, an adaptation, talks about his new film, Where the Wild Things Are, adapted from Maurice Sendak's children's book. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning music critic Tim Page talks about getting diagnosed with Asperger syndrome at the age of 45 and how it helped explain his strengths and weaknesses. He has a new memoir. Join us.